I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
If there's a winner in the Middle East today as a result of current U.S. policy, it's Iran. American forces removed the Taliban in Afghanistan, considered a threat by Iran. The U.S. invasion of Iraq weakened that country, which has been a long-standing enemy of Iran. In this country, there's a growing debate over U.S. Iran policy. The Senate voted to declare Iran's Revolutionary Guard a terrorist organization. Critics say this could give the Bush administration a reason to invade or attack Iran. Iran has also been in a standoff with the U.S., the EU, the UN, and the IAEA over its nuclear program. Our guest, Reese Ehrlich, is a freelance journalist who has reported on the Middle East and other issues for the Dallas Morning News, the CBC, and for National Public Radio. He was in Iran in the fall-winter of 2006, and he's the author of a new book. It's called The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis. And Reese Ehrlich, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Marty.
Would it be fair to say that the people in Iran know more about the U.S. than the people in the U.S. know about Iran?
It certainly is fair to say that. When I was in Iran, I always go out onto the streets, interview people at random, so it's impossible for the government to know or control who I talk to. Incredible level of knowledge about the United States, an incredible curiosity, and incredible friendliness.
Really?
Yeah. As an American reporter, everybody I met, without exception, was friendly, was hospitable. There was no antagonism to me individually. There was a lot of hatred for U.S. policy, and particularly President Bush's policies. But as an American, and by extension to American people, a lot of friendliness. And yeah, people started asking me questions. So I would get to ask them questions, and then they'd say, well, is the U.S. planning to attack Iran?
That was an issue even back then.
Yeah. Why is the U.S. interfering with our plans for nuclear power? What's Sean Penn really like? So there were all these.
Say you were traveling with Sean Penn, right?
I was indeed.
Is that
yes.
kind of an entree when you travel with a star like that?
I mean, it wasn't planned that way because he was going as a journalist. But he was recognized everywhere in the streets of Iran. And even a year later when I went back by myself, people would still spontaneously bring up, did you know that Sean Penn had visited Tehran? It was like a really, really big deal.
How hard is it, though, to get away, I guess, from the government minders? If you're in Iran and you want to talk mm-hmm. to people there about right. their government, about U.S. policy, how easy is it to do that?
Well, I've been there three times. When I first went there, you could hire any translator you wanted, and you were free to go anywhere you want, although the secret police figured out where we were and interfered with us at times. But it was much freer. And each subsequent trip, it's become more restrictive. So today, you have to go through kind of a quasi-government agency, pay them a lot of money, and they hire a freelancer translator who, depending on who the individual is, you can kind of get along. But then they have to report back everybody that you interview. So it's much more restrictive. You can still do interviews on your own, and I did in a variety of ways. But they really try to restrict your ability to report.
And what do they say about their president, Ahmadinejad, who, of course, was just in the U.S.?
Right. He is the key thing to understand about President Ahmadinejad is that he is a right-wing populist. So he's a fundamentalist Shia. He really believes in cracking down on women who are wearing their chador a little too far back on
with
their
the hair showing,
yeah,
right?
With a little hair showing, or any number of other sins, right? But he's also someone who came to office promising to put the country's oil wealth at the service of ordinary people. And he did things like lower the tuition fees of college students. And when you get married in Iran, you get a loan from the government, which is usually forgiven, and he doubled that. Subsidies of one kind or another. And people really appreciated that because in Iran, as the United States, economics is the heart of anybody's support for their government or not. But at the same time, inflation is a huge problem. Unemployment is a huge problem. So there's a lot more discontent with Ahmadinejad than he would care to admit.
And how much power does the president in Iran have compared to other mm-hmm. members of the government?
It's not quite a figurehead, but it's really a very weakened position. The real power is with the supreme religious leader, Khamenei. And he's the one who's in charge of the Revolutionary Guard, Khamenei. He's in control of government policy. He can veto virtually any decision made by Ahmadinejad or by the parliament or anybody else. So the idea of demonizing Ahmadinejad as the new Hitler and that he's this immense, immediate danger to the United States is just false. I mean, and people in Washington know it's false. The previous president tried to make various changes, and he couldn't because structurally and constitutionally, the president is actually very weak in Iran.
And I wonder when Ahmadinejad is called the next Hitler, or as that introduction to Columbia University underscored, whether that empowers the president in Iran, whether the Iranian people listen to how the U.S. talks about their president and feel more kindly towards him.
Yeah, there's no question that Bush's policies have actually strengthened Ahmadinejad, not weakened him. I interviewed Shirin Ebadi, who's the Nobel Peace Prize winner, many dissident Democrats, union leaders, student leaders from all different popular sectors. And to a person, without exception, they all said U.S. policy is counterproductive.
Really?
Yes. Not only threatening bombing, but even the U.N. sanctions and the economic embargo, et cetera, et cetera. Well, here's why it's negative for the people who are really fighting to bring back democracy to Iran, because every time they hold a demonstration, the government says, aha, those people are being backed by Bush. They're tools of the Americans. That gives us the right to crush them. Now, of course, a repressive government would make that argument
regardless, but it
has some traction because the U.S. is sponsoring some of these kind of groups. It is carrying out covert military attacks inside Iran, and people know that, and they think, well, maybe these groups are somehow connected. So it gives much more credence to the lies of the government, and therefore undercuts the ability of their... So a serious problem in their organizing is U.S. policy.
Well, and I didn't want to talk about the MEK, the PJAK, but let me begin first by talking more about Shirin Ebadi. As you say, won the Nobel Peace Prize, head of the Center for the Defense of Human Rights, other activists within Iran. What then would they like the United States to do?
They want the U.S. to just back off. You know, Iran is not an immediate threat to the United States or any of its neighbors, despite all the propaganda coming out of the U.S. The U.S., Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon, folks. What nuclear holocaust that Bush talks about? Iran does not have nuclear weapons today and is years from making it.
Do you think they want them in the future, that they are developing technology for weapons?
That's a tougher question. And what the IAEA says is you can't tell intentions. There's 40 countries in the world who currently have nuclear power, who have the capability of developing nuclear weapons. Are you going to go around embargoing and threatening to bomb all of them? No, you have to evaluate what in practice are they doing. And the IAEA says Iran is not currently enriching uranium beyond the levels needed for nuclear power. And you have to go by what they're doing now. What they're doing now is, according to the IAEA, legal under all the treaties and so on. That's what you have to go by. But back to Shirin Ebadi and so on, is that what they say, Iran is not a threat to the United States. It's a threat to its own people. It abuses human rights. It abuses women's rights. It's certainly workers' and unions' rights, etc. But the people of Iran are perfectly capable of dealing with that. So what they want the U.S. is just to stop interfering in the affairs of Iran, condemn human rights abuses in Iran, and help mobilize international public opinion against those repressions inside Iran. But that's very, very different from threatening to bomb them or blaming them for everything that goes wrong in Iraq.
Is Iran, though, a threat to its neighbors? I mean, certainly Iran has grown in power and stature as a result of the Iraq War.
Oh, for sure. Iran is sitting pretty. I've covered the area for many years now, and as you pointed out in your introduction, Iran benefited from the overthrow of the Taliban, a hated enemy. Iran has nothing to do with Al-Qaeda and Taliban. They almost went to war against the Taliban at one point. And, the minute you empower the Shias in Iraq, you empower Iran, because they have long-standing ties there. So, yes, I think Iran is supporting groups, militias, political parties in Iraq, as they have for years.
Right.
The irony is, it's the same groups the United States is supporting. The U.S. is arming militias under the guise of training the police and the army. They're really arming militias. And the parties that won the so-called democratic elections in Iraq, they're the ones supported by Iran. One of the parties, the second largest party in Iraq, has its headquarters in Tehran. I visited. You can go to it. open, you know, political party headquarters over there. So Iran has long-standing ties over there. They're probably supplying arms to groups they like. But that what where it breaks down is the U.S. has never shown that those arms are intentionally supplied in order to kill American soldiers. Iran wants Iraq. It does not want the U.S. troops to withdraw immediately from Iraq. They don't want it. It would be too destabilizing. So there's no, there's nothing in their interest that says, oh, take this RPG and shoot at Americans.
Then what do you make of the fact that a majority of the Senate voted to call the the Revolutionary Guard a terrorist organization?
Well, it won't be the first time the Senate's voted incorrectly, is it?
Is that how you see it, though?
Yeah. No, first of all, it's unprecedented to call the armed forces of another nation with whom you're not at war a terrorist organization.
And so our listeners know, the Revolutionary Guard is essentially the armed forces of Iran.
Yeah, you have a regular army. The Revolutionary Guards were formed after the 1979 Islamic Revolution as a parallel force to the army, basically. But yeah, they're part of the regular armed forces of Iran. And to call them a terrorist organization, first of all, is meaningless. And it's just unnecessarily ramps up the rhetoric against Iran. It's part of this demonization. Listeners need only go back to the run-up to the Iraq War. Oh my God, Saddam Hussein is helping terrorists. Oh my God, Saddam Hussein has aluminum tubes and mobile weapons, you know, chemical weapons lab, blah, 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 weapons of mass destruction, every one of which turned out to be a lie. So why should we be falling for it all over again with Iran?
But is this how you see it? Do you see those parallels then?
Absolutely.
People are talking about them, but do you see them as a reason for the U.S. to ramp up some kind of attack on Iran?
Well, I think it's the justification for it, yes. In other words, they're taking things that are real and exaggerating them, or just making things up entirely, and therefore using it. They want to overthrow the government in Iran, and they're trying to find reasons to justify it and to get political support here for doing it. And that's exactly what they had in mind with Iraq.
One of the, evidences of the Revolutionary Guard as some terrorist organization are the kinds of bombs, roadside bombs that have been found, and saying you can trace these back to the Revolutionary Guard. How do you see that?
Yeah, that's the so-called EFPs, or explosively formed penetrators. It's really interesting, and in my book I go into a great deal more detail on it. But basically, these are disks that are machined, and the U.S. claims they're so sophisticated they can only be machined in Iran, and they're brought in. You put an explosive underneath them, it blows up an armored vehicle and causes a great deal of damage. Those EFPs, those discs, have been used in Northern Ireland by the IRA against the British. They're used in Lebanon and other parts of the Middle East for years. They're commercially available for mining companies because they're used in mineral mining. So the idea that these are only used, they can only come from Iran, and it's absolute certainty that therefore Iran is trying to kill American soldiers, it's just one of these exaggerated myths I talked about. And they can be machined and are machined in Iraqi machine shops. So there's nothing special about those things that point to the Iran complicity.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Now, Reese Ehrlich is our guest today on Radio Times. He's a freelance journalist. He's reported on the Middle East for many years now, reporting for the Dallas Morning News, NPR, the CBC in Canada, and he's the author of a new book that's called The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Questions or comments? Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Gratz College, located in Melrose Park, a non-denominational institution promoting lifelong passionate Jewish enrichment. Registration is open for courses in Jewish studies, professional education, and communal service. To learn more about these programs or Gratz's accredited degree or professional certificate, 1-800-475-4635 or gratz.edu. Gratz College, transforming Jewish studies and professional education.
This is day three of the seven-day membership drive here at 91 FM. And we're asking you to make a pledge of support to 1-888-345-WHYY. That's 1-888-345-9499. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. The money that you invest in public radio comes back to you in the radio that you're listening to right now. So make a pledge of support to public radio here in the Delaware Valley. And from all of us here at 91 FM, we thank you for your support.
PhillyFunGuide.com supports WHYY with a complete listing of events like the Philadelphia Orchestra's Access Concert, Hide and Seek, October 25th, 7 p.m. at the Kimmel Center. Designed for the curious listener, this 75-minute concert takes you behind the scenes of the musical process of composer Franz Joseph Haydn. Information and tickets at philorc.org/access. Philadelphia Orchestra events and more featured on PhillyFunGuide.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Reese Ehrlich today on the show about Iran and the Middle East and U.S. policy. He's got a new book, and it's called The Iran Agenda. Also, he's speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at Arcadia University, and that's just outside of Philadelphia, and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And we've got calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. You write about two I guess they're cults. I'm not sure exactly what to call them, Reese, but two organizations that have been working, I guess, to either destabilize the Iranian government or overthrow the Iranian government. One of them is called MEK, and I wonder if you could talk about what MEK is, who the leaders are, and how it works.
Yeah, MEK stands for Mujahideen-e Khalq, and it's a group that began as a Marxist slash Muslim organization, guerrilla group in Iran. It fought against the Shah, it fought against the Khomeini government. Eventually it went into exile and ended up in Iraq and fought with the Iraqis against the Iran during that war, that very bloody war in the 80s. And that earned them the hatred of most people in Iran, as far as I can tell, and other experts have written. And today, interestingly enough, for a group that once considered itself a left-wing group, I guess, sits in a camp. The U.S. did not disrupt their camp when they came in and occupied Iraq in 03. In fact, there's evidence to indicate that they're being used now against Iran as a terrorist force, basically, or certainly to carry out guerrilla raids. So the U.S. did not disrupt this group. They have tremendous support among extreme conservatives here in the United States and in the U.S. Congress. And my information indicates that the U.S. officially, oh, by the way, the MEK is on the official State Department list of terrorist organizations.
I thought so. Just a minor detail here.
The U.S. can't be seen officially supporting a group like that's on its own terrorist list. But what happens is people inside the camps come to the U.S. military and they say, I've left the MEK. And the U.S. says, oh, great, are you for democracy? And they say, yes, I'm for democracy. And then they hand them an AK-47 and say, Iran is that way. So basically, they're using the MEK forces to carry out military attacks against Iran covertly without officially backing the MEK.
Well, and where they where are they headquartered, so to speak, in Iraq,
well,
right?
Well, yeah, they have a camp near the Iran border that they've had for a long time. It was set up by Saddam Hussein, and it continues to be allowed by the U.S. And they took away the heavy weapons, but they continue to allow them to have small arms. So it's very easy for them to infiltrate back into Iran. And they have offices and TV stations, et cetera, out of Europe, too.
And when you say someone from MEK goes to the U.S. military and says, I believe in democracy, and you say Iran is that way. Is that what you mean?
Well, I'm being a little facetious about it.
I thought so, but yes, I just wanted to
sure.
check.
No, I have a strange sense of humor. What happens is they are, once they have officially declared that they've left the MEK without any actual proof of having done so, they're then trained by the U.S. for these covert actions, which is part and parcel of similar actions that the U.S. is using Kurds and Baluchis and other ethnic minorities in Iran to carry out a covert war.
And this group, this MEK, is headed by a husband and wife team.
The Rajavis, who are, many people feel, is a very strange cult. She without going into a lot of detail, there's a lot of very strange sexual and other things going on.
Really?
Yeah, she was liked the husband of one of the other leaders and forced a divorce and married the guy. And, you know, it's like this incestuous cult and very, very fierce loyalty among the members, a blocking out of what other Iranian opposition groups are doing. So it has many aspects of a cult. And, you know, surprisingly, actually much to my surprise, they're very conservative members of Congress and American Enterprise. Oh, the woman from Florida, Ross Lethetan, I can't never pronounce her name, Cuban-American from Florida, for example, is a very strong supporter of the MEK. And American Enterprise Institute in Washington has had discussed the positive aspects of the MEK and so on. So, yeah, they have their supporters among conservatives here.
And you had mentioned some of the opposition groups within Iran today. How do they view
MEK? Universally condemn the MEK. I have never met in three trips to Iran and in numerous discussions with Iranians in and outside, I've never met any person living in Iran who supports the MEK. They claim to have this massive support, but they simply don't. And the number one reason cited is that they sided with Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War. It'd be like somebody fighting with Osama bin Laden in the part of planning the destruction of the Twin Towers and then coming back and saying, I'm here to liberate you.
Now, there's another group that you write about, PJAK, P-J-A-K, PJAK. Tell us about this group. How is it different from MEK, and how is it the same?
Yeah, it's a Kurdish-based group, and the Iranian Kurds, they're a political party and a military group, a guerrilla group, operating out of northern Iraq. And they are very closely affiliated with a Turkish Kurdish group called the PKK, or the Kurdistan Workers Party, which is also on the U.S. list of state-sponsored organizations. So, again, I visited personally there, met with the leaders, and did quite a bit of research, original research for the book. The PKK, that is the Turkish branch, carries out guerrilla raids in Turkey, for which the Turks are absolutely outraged. They are on terrorist organizations.
Right.
And Turkey just yesterday shelled northern Iraq to protest and to allegedly go after the PKK. PJAK, an affiliated organization, does the same thing into Iran, and it has backing, military support, arms, and training from the United States. So you have terrorists on one side of the border, freedom fighters, exact same group, freedom fighters on the other side of the border.
There was something you said about half of the followers of PJAK are women?
Yeah.
This seems
it is unusual.
Strange,
odd. It is unusual. They talk a great deal about women's rights, and I can't verify that objectively, but I certainly saw a lot of women dressed in green militia uniforms when I was visiting up there in the hill. So I would not doubt that there. And I visit also the other major Kurdish Iranian groups, and they had nowhere near the number of women participation. So it is an interesting, but again, the guy Abdullah Öcalan, the leader who's in jail in Turkey, is another strange cat who's was a nationalist and a Marxist at one time, shed the Marxism, and is now a Kurdish nationalist.
Well, and I guess in the sort of convoluted world of politics today, people, I guess, switching sides as politics change.
It seems to be de rigueur.
That's Reese Ehrlich, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about Iran, Iraq, U.S. policy in the Middle East, and he's the author of a new book called The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis. And we've got calls coming in to 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Reese, let's get some callers in on the conversation. We've got Eileen from Philadelphia joining us. Hi, Eileen. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Marty and Mr. Ehrlich. Thank you so much for the conversation.
Sure.
Very timely and informative. I wonder, as many Democratic families, my family and I were appalled at Hillary Clinton's stance on the proposed amendment dealing with Iran. Yesterday in the Times, I believe it was a column that mentioned that aside from her need to appear, quote-unquote, tough, the real hidden agenda here is her need to curry favor with the pro-Israel lobby. And I wonder if you would mind commenting on that, please, and I'll take my information off the air.
Thanks, sure. Eileen. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, what Eileen was referring to is this amendment or sense of the Senate motion sponsored by Senators Kyle and Lieberman that declared Iraq, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, that it should be declared a terrorist organization, and listed a whole bunch of other exaggerated claims about Iran. And Senator Hillary Clinton did vote for that. Senator Barack Obama was absent but said he would have voted against it.
In fact, I think 75 members of the
Senate it was 75-22. It was overwhelming support for that, yeah. It was a sense of the Senate. It was not a law, but still it was an indication of the sentiment in the Senate. Yes, I think Hillary Clinton has clearly positioned herself as trying to be strong on defense and a strong opponent to the war on terrorism, and voted for this, I think, both out of conviction, that is, she really does believe this stuff, and also she's very close to those folks in the United States who are supporting Israel, and the there's no question that the Israeli government is taking a very militant stand on Iran, is threatening to bomb Iran itself, probably mostly as a pressure tactic to encourage the U.S. to bomb Iran, and therefore trying to get everybody who is a supporter of Israel to take that stand.
Well, and as we know, the president of Iran, whom we mentioned earlier, has had some pretty extraordinary and bellicose statements against Iran. Yeah. And if I were living in that neighborhood, I would take Israel. I would take those comments seriously.
Let's take that on. There's no question that Ahmadinejad is, by his stands on the Holocaust, by questioning whether it really exists, is in essence denying the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And there's no question that he is taking a belligerently anti-Israeli stand. By the way, this whole thing about we're going to wipe Israel off the map is a mistranslation of an old slogan that's actually been around for a long time. But the key thing to... So there's no question that Ahmadinejad and some of the other leaders in Iran are both anti-Zionist and anti-Jewish.
And anti-Israel, wouldn't you say?
And anti-Israel, right. Absolutely. And there's others in Iran who are anti-Zionist and anti-Israel, but not anti-Jewish. So it's important to make that distinction. But nevertheless... Iran does not have the power or the ability to launch an offensive attack on Israel. And that's really the key question, because by claiming he's a Hitler and that Iran is the new Germany and that Israel faces a Holocaust and the entire Jewish people could be wiped out is a exaggeration for political gain and political interests. And that if here's the question that I ask people under these circumstances. If Iran is really such a danger, and oh my God, how, if they had nuclear weapons, what would happen to Israel? Why hasn't Iran launched an offensive conventional attack on Israel? They've been capable of doing that for many years. They have missiles, they have planes, they have bombs. They could do it. They don't do it, in part because it would guarantee the destruction of Iran and kill all the leadership. Israel would retaliate, the United States would retaliate, Western European powers, some of them would retaliate, and Iran would cease to exist. And they're not crazy. They are not berserk, insane people who want to go to heaven on the backs of cruise missiles. They are politicians whose number one desire in life is to survive.
There's talk, and we'll get back to our callers, there's also talk about divestment as another way of putting pressure on Iran. Do you think that would be an effective strategy? And again, based on your visits there and also people that you've talked to.
No, I don't. I actually think it's not a good idea. And, you have to look at these in South Africa as one situation. You have to look at every country individually. I think it just plays into the conservative efforts to demonize Iran here by doing this divestment movement. And you need to go no further than the leading human rights activists inside Iran who completely oppose all of those efforts, divestment or further sanctions. They say it actually has it's completely counterproductive.
Let me get Sam from Princeton to join us this morning on Radio Times. Hi, Sam. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
My call.
Sure, go ahead.
You hadn't mentioned the threats to Israel and Iran's support of the terrorist groups Hamas and Hezbollah, which are destabilizing the region. And your comment about Iran's not being serious about or capable of wiping out Israel, it's kind of a risky proposition, because if they are serious and they have the capability and they do launch a nuclear weapon, that could be the end of Israel. So it's a pretty big gamble not to take them seriously, don't you think?
It's a fair question, Sam.
Absolutely,
I appreciate the
Sam.
Call. Go ahead,
yeah, no, and I do appreciate the fact that I've heard this discussion. I've had this discussion elsewhere. I'm Jewish. I've been written about Jewish issues for many years. I've visited Israel 6 times, and I guess if I really thought the state of Israel was faced with an imminent destruction, well, then I think you have to really change your policies, right? But I just don't think it's the case. The first thing is, what Ahmadinejad is saying and doing is really not any different than previous leaders in Iran. It's been going on for many years. That quote about, we want to wipe Israel off the map, which is actually accurately translated as, the entity in Jerusalem should vanish from the pages of time, which is a very different meaning than wipe Israel off the map.
But that's still a threat.
Well, it says that they don't want Israel to exist as a Jewish state. They want all the Palestinians to return to Israel or to Palestine, and then there to be a vote of Muslims, Jews, and Christians, and whatever state they want, which means this current state of Israel would not exist.
Right.
So, but that's very different from saying, we're going to launch missiles and kill the Jews. There's a very, very big difference there. And so, so the policies that Iran has today is really not all that different from policies they've had for 28 years. And at one time, remember, Israel was a staunch supporter of Iran, sent arms and military supplies and munitions to Iran in the 1980s when it was fighting against Iraq. And Iran was just as anti-Jewish and just as anti-Israel and just as anti-Zionist as it is today. But Israel thought it was to its advantage.
And this was the Iran-Contra involved the U.S.
Highly documented. It's not something I'm making up here. If people want to go back and check it out. During Iran-Contra, and I have a good chapter in my book about this, Israel was a strong supporter of Iran, the evil anti-Israel Iran. So the question is, what has anything really changed in the election of Ahmadinejad has not changed the policies of Iran in any specific way. And yes, Sam alluded to or mentioned the fact that, yes, Iran supports Hamas financially. They support Hezbollah in Lebanon financially and with arms. And Israel doesn't like that. But that's very different from saying Iran is going to launch atomic weapons on Israel and kill the people of Israel.
Sam, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Just to follow up on that, though, and we talked about whether it's attack or divestment. I mean, would diplomacy in the sort of traditional sense, do you see that as an effort that would try to at least tamp down some of the conflict and some of the rhetoric back and forth?
It's worth noting that in 2003, Iran sent a formal letter to the Bush administration offering to negotiate all issues, including nuclear power, allegations of nuclear weapons, policy towards Israel, policy towards Lebanon, everything. Every single issue that's in dispute with the United States, they offered to negotiate it, and it was ignored by the Bush administration, I think largely because the U.S. was feeling high. This is right at the beginning of the launch of the Iraq War. The U.S. thought it was first Baghdad, then on to Tehran, etc. Today, the situation is very different. The U.S. has actually weakened very much so in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Iran thinks it's in the catbird seat. So I think negotiations would not be easy today. But yes, I think if the U.S. took steps to for example, take the military option off the table, would be a tremendous step forward. If it stopped efforts to economic sanctions against Iran and the UN, etc., if it took concrete steps to reduce the tensions, I think the Iranians would negotiate. The consequences of a military attack are such a disaster. What's the alternative but negotiations?
And we're almost up on a break here, but I think it's worth noting that Iran worked with the United States in dealing with the Taliban, right?
Oh, absolutely. The U.S. helped the United States overthrow the Taliban in Afghanistan. The Northern Alliance, Iran had supported them for years when the U.S. had just forgotten about Afghanistan altogether. And Iran made its contacts available through the Northern Alliance, and Afghan exiles living in Iran attended the famous conference in Germany that set up the current government. And the United States publicly thanked Iran for its efforts around that time, and then Iran was rewarded by being labeled as part of the axis of evil. So, the U.S. doesn't know how to take yes for an answer.
Well, let me reintroduce you. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation with our guest, and that's Reese Ehrlich. We're talking about Iran Iraq, the U.S., the Middle East, and he's got a new book called The Iran Agenda, and he's also a freelance journalist joining us here on Radio Times, and he'll be speaking tonight at Arcadia University at 7 o'clock, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Atwater Camp Museum and eight area cultural organizations support WHYY and present William Penn's Welcome Week, October 13th through 21st, celebrating 325 years since Penn's arrival. Details at ushistory.org/Penn.
Widener University supports WHYY. Widener has graduate programs in education, social work, business, engineering, and more. Widener is hosting a graduate open house on Thursday, October 18th on the main campus in Chester. To register, 1-888-WIDENER or widener.edu. Other programs available in nursing, physical therapy, hospitality management, and more. 1-888-WIDENER or online at widener.edu.
Believe it or not, we're almost halfway through the membership drive here at 91FM, and we want you to make a pledge of support to public radio here in the Delaware Valley to programs like Radio Times. Here's that phone number to call, and it's 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. Pledge online at WHYY.org. Know that your investment in public radio returns to you in the kind of radio that you're listening to right now. So make that pledge. Thank you very much.
Support for WHYY is provided by Freelancers Union at Working Today, providing health insurance, dental insurance, professional networking, and more to freelancers in a variety of industries. More at freelancersunion.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Reese Ehrlich is our guest. He's a freelance journalist. He has spent many years reporting on the Middle East and joins us this morning on Radio Times. And he's got a new book. It's called The Iran Agenda. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I mean, certainly there's a debate in this country about Iran and what the United States should or shouldn't do. And there are a number of questions that are raised when the question of Iran actually being bombed by the United States. And one is a look at the U.S. military. I mean, the U.S. military is stretched so thin in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's hard to imagine that anyone is seriously contemplating an attack on Iran.
Yeah, there's no question that the U.S. ground forces are stretched way too thin in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if there was an actual threat to the United States somewhere in the world, the U.S. would actually have trouble sending ground troops. But the Navy and the Air Force are perfectly capable of bombing Iran. That's what people, I think, don't understand, is that the plan is not to go in and invade and occupy Iran. That's so crazy. Not even the most conservative, hawkish people advocate that. The idea is you go and you bomb them for a week or 2 weeks. You take out nuclear facilities. You bomb Revolutionary Guard headquarters, camps, training camps. There are buildings in Tehran, which is very dangerous and will inevitably lead to civilian casualties. And then you have so weakened the government in Tehran that either the people rise up in a revolution against the regime. That's one theory advocated by some neocons. Or it so weakens the government they're incapable of carrying out activities against the United States in Iraq or elsewhere in the world. And that's right. Those who are advocating it, that's what they see happening.
And is that what the debate is about? I mean, do you think there's a serious debate within either the Bush administration, the U.S. government, about attacking Iran?
Oh, yeah, very serious debate. And I've written about it, but of course Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker last week wrote about it, an excellent article. And basically, there are people who advocate what I just said, and then the so-called realist camp, Condi Rice and Secretary of Defense Gates and others, who say, look, the consequences of an attack on Iran, it's not the immediate aftermath, it's like the weeks and the months later where all of those factions who are maybe holding back in Iraq today really do start attacking the U.S. troops in Iraq, and they're going to face a far worse situation than they do today. A war could very well break out between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon again, with Hamas as a second front, and the danger of terrorist attacks in Europe or even in the United States of those who are supporting, who are opposed to what the U.S. is doing, as we've seen as a result of the war in Iraq. So it's exactly parallel. There was no terrorist threat in Iraq in the sense of al-Qaeda prior to the war, but there are terrorists operating in Iraq today. There is no Iranian terrorist threat in Europe or the United States today in the sense of blowing up buildings or dirty bombs or anything, but there very well could be if the United States attacks Iran, because then kind of all bets are off.
Let me get back to our callers. We've got Faith from Philadelphia joining us. Hi, Faith. Go ahead. Your radio times.
Yes. Hi. My father installed the first satellite system in Iran when the Shah was in power, and I haven't heard anything yet about the American overthrow of Mossadegh in 1952. And how that contributes to anti-American sentiment in Iran.
And Faith, just one quick question about your father. What was he doing in Iran?
Well, the United States wanted to support the Shah, which, you know, we installed the Shah.
Right.
And so he was over there installing the first satellite system that they had for communications.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, let's go back. There's a lot of history here, Reese Erlich.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Faith. Thank you so much for the call, Faith. The situation, you know, it's really ironic. The U.S. talks about how it wants to bring democracy to the Middle East, and that's our goal, ostensibly. In early 1950s, Iran had a democracy, and it wasn't just people voting, but it was a real functioning democracy with freedom of the press and civil society institutions and independent trade unions and independent religious groups. And really, it was a bustling, dynamic democracy. It was a democracy that voted to nationalized British oil, and that was considered beyond the pale. So the British illegally blockaded, shut down their oil production in Iran. They illegally blockaded the ships coming out of Iran, et cetera, and they came to the United States and demanded the U.S. overthrow the Mossadegh government, the elected government. President Truman, to his credit, refused, but when President Eisenhower was elected, they went along with it, the Dulles brothers, and so on. And in the next year, by 1953, the U.S. Used terrorist tactics. They assassinated people. They kidnapped people. They claimed that some group bombed another group when it hadn't. It set off bombs to discredit mainly the Communist Party, the Tudeh Party. So they used all these methods that, of course, the U.S. rails against others when they do it. And they overthrew the government and installed the Shah as the full-time dictator. And his rule, his dictatorial rule, led directly to the 1979 revolution against him and the current government that we have today. So in a very real way, had the U.S. not overthrown the democratic government of Iran in 53, we wouldn't have seen a 79 revolution, and we wouldn't be in the situation that we're in today.
And this is the history that obviously the Iranian people know, because they lived through it, or they had family members who lived through it, but might not be the history that America
understands.
It certainly
was never in any textbook I ever studied here. Sorry. But if people think, oh, who's that? Or like, why is he blowing smoke at us again? Go to the New York Times, and the actual documents detailing the coup written by the CIA are online. There's also an excellent book by Stephen Kinzer called All the Shah's Men.
Yes.
And it's part of the historic record. It's all there.
Let me get Faith, thanks for the call. We've got Greg from Marlboro, New Jersey, joining us. Hi, Greg. Go ahead. Your radio times.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
Very interesting show. I really appreciate this angle on Iran. I'm of Armenian descent. My wife is from Armenia, and I've been there several times. And Armenia has been forced to have Iran as one of its major trading partners, and they're actually quite an excellent trading partner. And Armenia is a very ancient Christian country. There seems to be no problem that there's a lot of communication between the two countries, and trade is going quite well. And I know that Iran has, as you have pointed out, has made a lot of attempts to have the United States as a trade partner, and we've ignored that. But also, you've commented on those things. The other thing I wanted to point out was that I think that this whole thing that Ahmadinejad has been doing with the Holocaust is just like a tongue-in-cheek thing from the policy of the United States, Israel, and Turkey towards the Armenian genocide. You know, he's just doing exactly what those three countries have worked together and decided to put it in the hands of the historian. So it's, you know, I always get the feeling that he's kind of saying, well, you know, here, if you're going to do that, question that one. Why don't we question this one, too?
Well, that's interesting. Greg, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Reese, your thoughts?
Thanks, Greg. Well, first of all, I have to say that I really do think Ahmadinejad questions the Holocaust against Jews and others in Europe. And unfortunately, it's part of a both anti-Zionist and anti-Jewish ideology that is often said to completely dominate. Everybody in the Middle East thinks that. It's not true. most people in the Middle East that I've run into, most Iranians I've met, are critical of Israel but not anti-Jewish. But I, unfortunately, I think in the case of Ahmadinejad, he's both. And so
not tongue-in-cheek, you're saying.
No, I don't think it's tongue-in-cheek. I think he's serious, unfortunately. And, of course, by taking that stand, it gives the perfect opening to the Bush administration and others and the Israeli leadership to vilify him as another Hitler, etc. As to, you know, I mean, it is interesting, the whole situation now with Turkey and the Armenian genocide issue coming up before Congress. And the irony, of course, is that, of course, there was an Armenian genocide. That's historic record. And to deny that is as bad as denying the Holocaust in Europe. But Turkey doesn't want to come anywhere near that one, and it's liable to disrupt the relations. So the Turks are now threatening to cut off all the help and insular base transshipments of supplies to Iraq, which is going to cause tremendous problems for the U.S. and Iraq. So it's ironic that this kind of historic question can come into to play and cause such havoc.
Thanks for the call, Greg. We've got Rosemary from Princeton joining us. Hi, Rosemary. Go ahead, your Radio Times. And that would be number 7, yes. We got a lot going on in our studio today. Go ahead, Rosemary, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for this program.
Sure.
I really want to commend you both. This is exactly how journalism should work.
Oh, thanks.
Uncovering the veil whenever, you know, war is in the offing. I just wondered if your speaker had heard about a recent YouTube presentation by Ralph Nader, in which he's talking about Stockbridge, Mass, and the communities in that area that voted 2/3 to ask their congressmen to open impeachment hearings. And John Oliver, who is the congressman from that area, flatly refused because he said if the Democrats did that, our government would attack Iran by air, declare martial law, and then cancel the 08 elections. I just wondered if you'd heard that, and, you know, given how scary all of that is, what your reflection on it would be.
Okay.
And I also understand.
You know, Rosemary? Yeah, yeah, hold on, only because we had a lot of callers. I want to address that one. Yeah.
No, I hadn't seen that, actually. That's pretty incredible. If that's true, that's pretty incredible. Seems to run afoul somewhat of the Constitution, a military coup here. But, you know, it's funny. I hear variations of that from people who are opposed to Bush's policies, that he's so powerful that anything is, you know, up to including fascist martial law. I don't think that's not on the agenda. I think, and what's more, when you talk in those terms, it is actually discouraging. For example, there's big anti-war demonstrations coming out on October 27th in Philadelphia and other parts of the country. And people who feel so discouraged about the Bush's power will probably not come out to a demonstration. And I think that's exactly the opposite attitude that should prevail, which is that if you don't agree with the government policies, get out and do something about it.
Rosemary, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're talking with Reese Ehrlich today on the show. He's got a new book. It's called The Iran Agenda. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia.
And good morning. I'm Susan Greenbaum here with Devorah Lissick. We are two of the producers of Radio Times here to remind you that this is your first opportunity during the shortened October membership drive to become a member of WHYY during Radio Times and in a way show your support for Marty, who's here every day, Monday through Friday, 10 hours a week in the studio, not counting all the work she does behind the scenes. And it's your opportunity to show your support for this program and others, of course, by becoming a member of WHYY, giving us a call at 1-888-345-9499.
That's right. This is your first chance to pledge for Radio Times for the programming that you tune into every day at 10 a.m. when you're driving in your car, you're at work, and you think, I wonder what Marty's talking about today. I wonder who she's talking to. And today you tuned in and heard a really interesting conversation about Iran, which is an important conversation to be had. There's lots of information floating around out there, and we are hoping to bring that to you. And that is why you tuned in, because you want to be informed.
Thank you.
And about what's going on in the world. So, if that is you, as those people who have just called in, and thank you so much for making those calls, call us now, pick up your phone, and call 1-888-345-9499. 345-9499. It takes 91 seconds, as they say, to give your information to the volunteers that are sitting by waiting to hear from you, and then you will go on with your day knowing that you became a member of WHYY.
And did a good thing.
Yes.
We'll just remind you that for your membership pledge of $60, it would be our pleasure to send you the Radio Times 20th anniversary mug.
Is this new? I haven't seen this.
I think it is new. It's our 20th anniversary.
It's beautiful, actually.
So please do give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. WHYY.org is the place to pledge online. And again, if you ask for it, it would be our pleasure to send you an official Radio Times 20th anniversary mug. Devor, I think this morning is a really outstanding example of the breadth of topics Marty is able to cover day in and day out on Radio Times. In hour one, as we mentioned, we're talking about Iran. In hour two, it's a conversation with violinist Eugene
Drucker.
And you produced this show. Can you just tell us just about Eugene briefly?
Well, he is one of the founding members of the Emerson String Quartet, and they are actually playing tonight at the Kimmel Center. And Eugene is a violinist, and he also just recently wrote a novel called The Savior, which is about the Holocaust and music, and it's also a personal story in his family. So it should be a really interesting hour. We're going to play some different clips and actually listen to music in a slightly different way and talk about it in a slightly different way than we usually do. So that's
and
be
we
a good
do
hour.
Always marvel at Marty, her ability to digest music, to take it apart,
right?
And really, she teaches us an awful lot when we produce a music show, because she really just has this great understanding of music and its potential and its differences,
right,
and all that stuff.
And how and makes everybody be able to relate to it, even if you've never listened to St.
Right.
Matthew's Passion. Well, today you're going to hear a little clip of it and have it in a slightly different context. So
if this programming is important to you, again, we're going to give you that number, 1-888-345-9499. WHYY.org is the place to pledge online. Please do give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. As we've mentioned, this is your first opportunity to become a member of WHYY, to make your pledge during Radio Times. So please do show your support for what we're doing here by giving us a call at 1-888-345-9499. And we've been talking about arts and culture, and we've been talking about the way Marty's able to make this segue from hard news to talking with directors and filmmakers and
Are you
novelists.
Are going to make a segue?
I am going to make a segue.
Oh, good.
Because we have a special guest here in our studio. I guess you're not supposed to explain this segue, right? And that is Terry Nolan, who's with the Arden Theater. And he is here to talk about a special challenge we have this week during Radio Times. Terry,
welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
You've been
down.
A guest on Radio Times several times.
Yes.
To make this important announcement.
I'm here to announce the Independence Foundation Challenge. If we receive 800 callers during Radio Times by noon Friday, the Independence Foundation will make an additional gift of $10,000 to WHYY.
Wow.
So it's a challenge that will go on throughout Radio Times throughout this week. And as you say, I've been on Marty's shows a couple of times.
Yes, you have.
And
talking about works at the Arden Theater.
Talking about plays we've done.
Yes.
And talking about playwrights, Arthur Miller. And
that's right.
There's no more exciting time than to spend time in a studio with Marty. She is curious. She's so engaged. I personally listen to her every morning.
Well, thank you.
And I'm hoping people will support this drive.
Well, let's recap that. First thing is the phone number, 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. If you become a member of WHYY during Radio Times, that's between 10 and 12, between now and Friday midday, the Independence Foundation will honor the pledges of 800 people just like you by